Inside Lacrosse Podcast.
Thank you for checking out the Inside Lacrosse Podcast. I am Terry Foy. We are back for week two of our rejuvenated Inside Lacrosse Podcast. We're back up on iTunes, bringing you a full slate of daily episodes, so make sure you check us out on InsideLacrosse.com, on iTunes, Inside Lacrosse Podcast. And if you like what you hear, please, we're not begging yet, but we'll probably get around to it before long. Just send out a tweet, a Facebook post, an Instagram, a Snapchat, whatever it takes to spread the word. Let your friends know that you can get some pretty great audio lacrosse talk here at Inside Lacrosse Podcasts. We're going to be coming at you with the Reflex Podcast on your Monday, taking you around the country to where some of the IL bloggers and correspondents were taking in just an amazing, amazing set of games this weekend. Three overtime contests, another one in Western Pennsylvania decided by one goal that we'll be getting to. But first, I just kind of wanted to talk about my general thoughts on this weekend because I was a little disappointed, got busy at the end of last week, and wasn't able to post kind of a February look back, a reflex, as it were, to the whole month. I think that lacrosse fans are in some ways still adjusting to the idea of so much of the season, so many influential things happening in February, when really only, you know, probably about a decade ago or so, most teams weren't even playing games until March 1st. So, you know, it's an interesting paradigm shift, and as a result, the idea of 31 or two-goal games out of 81 games played in February, 30 were decided by one or two goals. Five, by my count, really, you know, notable upsets, although, as Quinn Kostnick likes to say, there's no such thing as an upset in the early season. Just trying to recalibrate expectations for teams. But I still think that it's fair to say that a team like Albany, coming off of the year that they had in 2012, taking down a team like Syracuse, a perennial powerhouse, that qualifies as an upset. So does High Point, a first-year program, taking down a prominent program like Towson. So a lot going on as far as the upsets in February go. And then, obviously, you know, kind of the crown jewel of the month as far as games go, number one versus number two, Maryland versus Loyola, that type of matchup being played early in the season, just a real significant thing for the sport of lacrosse. And so I was disappointed not to be able to write that column and share it with readers, etc., but then this weekend happened, and it kind of made me feel a little bit vindicated because the results as they started rolling in, particularly in that 3 o'clock window, when the 1 o'clock games were ending, but then it was also, you know, it continued to go a little later. There was about a 2 hour period where I think the 3 o'clock games were ending. It was just result after result that made you scratch your head. And my top surprises from the weekend, leading off, Mark had another first-year program, the second of the two first-year programs in 2013, beating Air Force. It's one thing to go out to the Rocky Mountains and play. It's another thing to go out there and get a win, and it's a third thing to do it against an Air Force team that I expect to compete for an NCAA spot. I thought, and still do think, the Falcons are for real. So for Coach Joe Amplo's squad to be able to do that is really impressive. I thought that Vermont beating Bryant, a team that was probably as looked at as a perennial possible breakthrough team as any, was a significant surprise. Bryant is now 0-4. That's kind of a bigger picture surprise than one result from the weekend, but that, you know, definitely makes me it's not something I would have expected about a month ago. Yale winning big over Albany, 15-8. Limiting the Danes to only 8 goals and putting together a 7-goal win. That's impressive for the Elis and Coach Andy Shea's squad. Brown beating UMass, a UMass team that had beaten North Carolina a couple weeks ago. A nice win for Lars Tiffany and the Brown Bears. Certainly one that I think made some people turn their heads. Colgate only mustering 3 goals against Cornell. I've always been really high on the Cornell defense. I think that not only the continuity, but also the types of players that Mike Bronzino and Jason Noble are, you know, they're good players, and they might be small, but they are very quick. They play well with their sticks, and obviously gave fits to the Colgate offense, a very vaunted Colgate offense. And then finally, I think And I didn't get a chance to see the game, but I was just surprised to hear what some folks said about the Cuse Virginia game. Not the fact that it was an overtime goal, not the fact that it was an overtime game, or the fact that Syracuse came out on top. Neither of those were tremendous surprises to me. It was more the fact that they weren't able to muster very many goals. It was a relatively tame affair and a little bit sloppy at times offensively. That's a surprise to me because that's obviously a you know, crown jewel game for the sport of lacrosse, and for those two programs not to necessarily put their best offensive foot forward is a little bit of a surprise. So let's start there. We're going to talk to Dave Ramey and kick off the Reflex Podcast. And the Inside Lacrosse Reflex Podcast kicks off our segment whipping around the country, talking to folks who took in some of the best games of the weekend with Dave Ramey, blogging the game for InsideLacrosse.com, bringing you the Orange 9-8 overtime victory over Virginia in the Carrier Dome Friday night. You know, Dave, another overtime classic. Not necessarily the same offensive tempo that fans of this series are accustomed to seeing, but at the same time, you know, certainly tense down the stretch, which is absolutely par for the course for this one. I guess just in general, how did the way this game unfolded compare to what your expectations were and, you know, kind of what you've come to see out of this, you know, relatively epic matchup year in, year out?
Well, I think it was... It was typical and then very atypical of this series, which is one of the best rivalries in all sports, in my opinion. I mean, they played 28 times and three goals separate them. You know, I think Virginia's won 15 of the 28. And, you know, it's just a really close, usually an up-tempo, back-and-forth contest when they play. I've seen these teams play to 22-21 scores and 18-17 and 17-15. And this had a lot of that kind of action in it. It was just crazy at times. You couldn't even describe some 2 or 3 minute sequences. The ball was flying around like it had been in the pinball machine. Bodies were flying around, unsettled situations back and forth. The big difference in this game, as opposed to past SU Virginia games, was that the ball wasn't going into the cage at the end. Just unbelievable, great opportunities. And what makes it even more incredible is that neither goalie was great. I mean, they combined for 16 saves. You can see maybe that happening, going back and forth and having a low-scoring game if the goalies are standing on their heads. And that wasn't the case at all, especially early for SU's Bobby Wardwell. I mean, Virginia was – now, they have some great shooters on that team, but they're, you know – they're taking shots from the 12 to 15 yard range. I call that the save range for a goalie, and they were scoring. So it was 4-3 after one period. And then really two things slowed down the scoring, if not the excitement and the hitting. And that is, as it did last year and is pretty uncharacteristic historically, Virginia went into a zone after the first quarter. Syracuse's midfielders ran past Virginia's midfielders. It was a 4-3 Syracuse lead in the first quarter. And, you know, Dom Starcia went to his own defense. And anytime a team goes to his own defense, it's going to slow down the pace, shot clock or no shot clock or whatever they want to call it. You know, and that happened. And Syracuse's defense stepped up and really got aggressive and started really pushing out against Virginia's attackmen and midfielders, and that combined to keep the score down. But I don't want to give folks the misimpression that this wasn't, you know, that it was a slow, settled kind of game, because there were some crazy sequences in this game, just like in the past, just not goals that finished those sequences.
How do you put a finger on the fact that Syracuse was able to win this game despite only winning 5 of 21 faceoffs and 8 out of 9 in the from the second half on?
Another incredible statistic. I mean, how does Virginia, how does any Virginia team in the recent or distant past win 16 of 21 faceoffs and not score double-digit goals? It was just one of those, you know, it was just another stat that jumped off the page at you and you said, how did this happen? And again, there were a lot of unforced errors after faceoff wins. First of all, Virginia's wing play on faceoffs is incredibly good, and Syracuse tried to double pole to offset that. Anything they tried really didn't work. There were a lot of clean faceoff wins by Nick Parks, but there was also a lot of ground balls where Chris Daddio or the other guys that SU tried at the X actually got the ball out, and Virginia's wing play is just so outstanding. They get possession, but they followed up a lot of those possessions with just goofy. I mean, passes over guys' heads and you know, it's just it was sloppy in that regard. And I think that when Dom looks at the film, he'll see that they probably, you know, passed up 5 or 6 possessions in that regard. So that kind of evened that face-off discrepancy a little bit. But again, you win 16 of 21 at the X and you have an offense that was averaging 15 and a half goals a game going in, you would assume that there's going to be more than 8 goals scored by your team in that game. So that's a head scratcher.
Yeah, turnover is the great equalizer, but the thing there is that, you know, the Syracuse only had a plus one advantage in that regard too. So just, you know, looking at the box score for fans and certainly rightfully, you know, kind of griping about not being able to see this game on TV, just trying to get a quick understanding of how things unfolded. What was your impression of overtime and you know, Virginia getting a faceoff win, Bobby Wardwell getting a save, but that's kind of all you can glean from the box score.
Yeah, it was first of all, again, in that critical faceoff, Chris Daddio won that faceoff, had the ball on his stick at the X, and just dropped it. I mean, so you think, wow, this is going to be weird. They're going to win this. They're going to win the draw, and after losing just about every draw in the second half, they're going to win the one in overtime. And he actually has that ball in his cross and just drops it, and Virginia gets the ball. And you know, it looked to me. I've covered Syracuse lacrosse for a long, long time. So I might be tainted towards Syracuse just because it's natural to do that. But I have to tell you, it looked to me like the referees were just going to let these teams play. I think it was Matt White who made a drive, started to make a drive to the cage, and he really got accosted, let's say. it could have easily been a hold call there. If not worse. And so the shot that he got off was very weak. It was like a dribbler. It was like a one bouncer right into Wardwell's stick. So it wasn't like Bobby came up with a huge save in overtime. And, you know, Dom won the faceoff and he didn't call the timeout, which is what coaches usually do when he got it in the box. He had the guys on the field he wanted. He was struggling against Syracuse's defense. So I think he said, let's just not let them call a time. Let's not call a timeout and let them get settled on defense. Let's just go with it. And again, it was not a great shot because of certain circumstances that surrounded it. And then Syracuse clears it, and they kind of had a chance. Brian McGill, their great close defenseman, who did such a great job on Mark Cochran in that game, has it down, and he looks across the field where another long pole, the long stick midfielder, Matt Harris, had also gone across, and he was kind of standing all alone from about 15 yards to the left of Dan Marino. And, you know, McGill looked, and Harris had already scored a goal in the game, and there weren't a lot of great chances. And, you know, they finally just took it in the box, and they called a timeout, and then they set up their offense against this zone defense, which basically, the entire final three quarters of the game, Syracuse tried to force the ball, move the ball outside around that zone, and then tuck the ball inside to Luke Cometti or Derek Maltz with very little success. And it looked like they tried that a couple times, and the ball was loose, the ball was on the ground, and just inured to their advantage, the luck of the bounce, the ball kept going on. Rolling back to a Syracuse guy. And then really the way it ended was very anticlimactic. They're passing the ball around the zone. All of a sudden it comes out to Kevin Rice, who's about 10 yards to the right of Marino, out in front and to the right, and nobody was around him. And he's usually a feeder. He's not a big scorer, and he had time to set his feet, and he cupped it in the upper post over Marino's left shoulder, far side. And that was the game. So with all the crazy stuff that happened, it was kind of just an average goal. It was kind of weird, but it was a weird night.
Yeah, absolutely. And one of the other things to take away from this, nobody came away from this game with more than 2 points. Were there any performances that really stood out to you?
I think that I really thought that, believe it or not, is not a guy who's not going to get in the paper, and he's not going to get in the headlines, but I thought that Syracuse senior short stick defensive midfielder Matt Pratt had a fabulous game. He's very aggressive. Virginia shorties could do nothing with him, even though they have a little size advantage. They couldn't get around them. They tried. They took him behind. You know, they tried to play a little two-man game behind. They tried a lot of things with Matt, and he stood tall the entire game and scored a goal in transitions. So, you know, that's a great game for him. And, of course, Perdon scores two goals early, once on the man up and then once on a garbage goal where a rebound just popped out in front and he was there. And from that point on, Brian McGill did a great job on him. And the third, I thought, outstanding performance was by Brandon Mullins on Virginia's leading scorer, O'Reilly, and he was shut out in that game. The bad news is that Brandon Mullins, you know, ran out of the box and onto the field with Virginia in transition and tried to line up Chris LaPerriere, who was coming into the SU box, and LaPerriere saw him and stopped, and Mullins went past him, and the next thing you know, he's on the turf, clutching his knee. I covered football for a long time and lacrosse for a long time, and whenever you see that kind of reaction, you get really worried. And he was on the turf for a while. It's about 5 minutes left in the game. Had to be helped off the field. I still don't have an update on him, but my suspicion is that's not good news for Syracuse. Just based on what I saw, there's a kid who is an all-state linebacker in Texas who chose to play lacrosse in college rather than play football. And I'm telling you now, he's really fast. He's big. He's active. And he was blossoming, in my opinion, as a true sophomore into a real star. So we'll see what happens there. But, you know, obviously in a 9-8 game, the standout performances I saw were defensive performances by Syracuse. And, you know, Chris LaPerriere, who played for Virginia after the 3-game absence, clearly wasn't himself. He had some opportunities, one especially in the fourth quarter where he was coming in and just, you know, had Wardwell dead to rights from about 12. And you know that this guy's got a cannon, and he just fired it over the net. So, you know, that was basically the things I saw from individuals.
And then finally, you know, this isn't necessarily what this podcast is about, but, you know, coming out of a Syracuse-Virginia game, and particularly on a weekend when 10 of the top 20 teams lose, you know, I think that both of these teams were coming into this season looking for answers a little bit, and at this point, you know, through early March, I think that, you know, in some ways they've kind of figured out who they are, in other ways they're still, you know, on the hunt for answers. What do you see out of each of these squads going forward?
Well, I think that Virginia, and again, that's the first time I've gotten to see them. I think Dom hit the nail right on the head afterwards. They just seem to step slow. Now, they have played 5 games early in the season, and they had played Tuesday. So, you know, they didn't have the preparation time, and they had to go to the Dome. So you look at all those things, and, you know, I wouldn't push the panic button if I were Virginia, although I do think that they're not as explosive based on this game that I saw as they've been in the past. They don't have that dynamic offensive player. They have good offensive players, obviously, and they're big and physical and fast. You know, but it just worried me that against what I consider a very limited Syracuse offense, at least from what I've seen in 3 games, that Dom had to go to his own defense so early. You know, that's something that, you know, a concern. So I think that they have to figure out things at both ends of the field. Syracuse is very good defensively. I think it was an anomaly, the Albany game. It was one of the worst defensive efforts I've ever seen from a Syracuse team, and I don't know where their heads were. I could make a suggestion, but it probably wouldn't be repeatable on your podcast. But it was – you know, they are very limited offensively, though. That's what I see. If I'm an opposing coach, I shut off Maltz with the shorty. I put my best pole on Marasco at midfield and have a quick slide to him, and I dare the rest of the team to try to beat me. And I think right now, 3 games into the season, obviously the loss of Nicky Galasso is huge for Syracuse. I think 3 games into the season, if you do those two things and get a decent game from your goalie, you'd be hard pressed to get Syracuse in double digits. And that is so shocking for lacrosse fans who have watched this game over the years and have seen Syracuse always willing to score, to trade a goal on defense, to score two on offense, being so limited, at least 3 games into the season on offense. So I still think they have some work to do on that side of the field if they're going to be a title contender. Virginia, you know, I think they have some work to do too. So it's kind of interesting, the two teams that have won so many national championships. I would probably, based on what I saw on that night, put them both in the number 10 to number 15 range in the country.
Well, Dave Ramey, thank you so much. We're going to continue to follow as you bring us all the latest from the Syracuse area, and certainly the Brandon Mullins injury, a storyline to watch for Orange fans throughout this week. Thanks so much for joining us on the podcast. We'll talk to you again soon.
Take care, Terry.
And the Inside Lacrosse Reflex podcast continues with Vicky Jacobson, Notre Dame student who was blogging the Fighting Irish's overtime game winner over North Carolina, 10-9 on Saturday as the Fighting Irish advanced to 3-0. Matt Cavanaugh getting his second overtime goal to win in as many weeks. Vicky, it had to have been an amazing scene and quite an incredible game. What was it like, just kind of from your perspective, taking in the scene and you know, the crowd getting into the game and that sort of thing?
Well, towards the end, things were getting a little bit, we're really, really tense. Actually, one of my friends from my dorm was a student worker at the game, and she was sitting next to me. And towards the end, she just, couldn't look. She was, just so nervous. And there was a surprising amount of UNC fans in the crowd. There was a really good turnout, considering that it was about 28 degrees the whole time. But there were especially a lot of kids. And just a lot of people from out in town. So they're pretty full stands for an early season matchup. I mean, obviously in top 10, we all knew that it was going to be a good game, but it was just really a pretty incredible atmosphere.
Yeah, no doubt. And certainly, as you mentioned, for an early season contest, pretty remarkable, kind of the quality of play. And I understand that, you're still kind of getting, you're learning a little bit about lacrosse, kind of getting used to the game. But, did a fine job bringing Inside Lacrosse readers the game. What was, kind of the tempo? And certainly, as I understand it, Notre Dame was able to make a little bit of a run to kind of tighten the gap a little bit heading into the end of regulation, just kind of as things wound down, how did the game unfold?
Well, in the first half especially, things were, they were just playing at an incredible pace. I mean, I know, lacrosse is the fastest game on 2 feet, they like to say, but it really was striking. I kind of, looked at some of the other people covering the game. It's like, you really think they can keep this up for, four quarters? And, they really didn't. Towards the, the third quarter and the fourth, they were, keeping it clean, but it was a little bit more physical. Towards, in the third quarter and into the beginning of the fourth, it really seemed that UNC just had everything under control. And it almost seemed like Notre Dame was getting left behind. And, just as I was about to, update, the blog with, a post to that effect, Kavanaugh came in and scored, I think that would have been his second goal of the day, about midway through the fourth period. And, at that point, we were just wondering, is this going to be another comeback win? Can Notre Dame really do that again? Can they always leave it so late in the game? But with about a minute left, they just kind of seemed to have this air about them, like, we're gonna get those last two goals and force an overtime. So, and they were able to do it, so.
And you mentioned Matt Cavanaugh, 4 goals, 2 assists, another overtime game winner. Just speaking with folks around the Notre Dame program after the game, what was kind of the sentiment about a guy who's come in as a freshman, obviously given the offense an added dimension and shown up in so many clutch moments now?
Well, right after the game, I asked, about our goalie, John Kemp, and, he's in his senior year now and has done so much for the program. And, Coach Corrigan sort of gave me the line, oh, I don't know, what else I can say about him. But it's kind of funny, when I asked about Kavanaugh, he almost gave me kind of the same response, just like, he's just good. Like, I just always expect him to come up big in these situations. And, I remember reading even after our first game that, the other guys in the program were like, yeah, we're not surprised at all. He's got a little bit more experience than a lot of freshmen would have. He did a post-grad year instead of just going straight to college, and he said that that really helped him. And he also, led the U.S. team at the under-19 championships last year and was named tournament MVP. So, yeah, it's kind of funny. Everybody's like, yeah, he's a freshman, but we've almost come to expect him to come through in those big moments.
And he certainly did yet again as the Irish, one of the few teams coming away from a weekend in which 10 of the top 20 fell, to kind of continue on their positive trajectory, now capitalizing on three big early season contests. Vicky, thank you so much for joining us on the Reflux Podcast, and we appreciate your time. Hopefully we'll talk again somewhere down the line.
Okay, thanks. Look forward to it.
And the Inside Lacrosse Reflux Podcast continues with Pat White, contributor out of State College, as the Penn State Nittany Lions fall in overtime again this week to Ohio State, as the Creator's Trophy seems squarely in the Buckeyes' grasp. Pat, we talked to you last week after the Notre Dame overtime win, and it was an interesting question. It was kind of, you know, against a team that was as hot as Notre Dame was and as good as Notre Dame looked to be, and certainly they ended up on the other side of a similar result this week in South Bend. The question was, what does Jeff D'Ambrone say to his team in terms of taking away positives? And now, you know, after kind of falling again for the second week in a row, they're 2-2, and you know, this time against an Ohio State team that I think, you know, they probably had expectations of being able to take care of, and not to mention the fashion in which the game kind of unraveled there late. What are your sense, you know, what's your sentiment on this Penn State team and kind of where they're at this point in the season?
Right now, Jeff D'Ambrone said that his team was tired this week, that it was a rough week of practice. And with spring break coming up right now for Penn State this week, he said that he's just going to give his guys rest and come out with a little bit of fire this weekend, upcoming against Lehigh in Philadelphia, which is another ranked opponent for Penn State, which is their fourth and their first six games, so it's been a little bit of a rough stretch for the Nittany Lions. D'Ambrone wants to rest them up and get them refocused and refired up for the season, because it is a long season, it's early on, and this team has showed that they have flashes of brilliance. They just need to put it together right now.
TJ Sanders scored to go up 8-2 with 9 seconds to go in the second quarter, and then Ohio State really came out of halftime taking control. What did you see out of the Buckeyes that allowed them to reverse the course of this game and score the next seven goals?
The first half, they looked very flat. They were pretty stagnant on offense. They weren't moving a lot. The sideline was pretty flat. And Penn State just came out on fire, ready to play. And Ohio State, I guess Nick Myers said something in the locker room that got the energy levels boosted a little bit, because the sideline was louder. Every save that goaltender Greg Dutton made, the sideline was jumping up and down. Every shot, every goal. It was the team support on the sideline was the big thing that I noticed. And then a little bit more movement on offense. It wasn't as stagnant. They came out, dodged a little bit more, used their attack in fashions that opened up a little bit more scoring and a little bit more space on the crease for Jesse King, who ended up scoring three goals on the day. And credit to Ohio State, they came out with a lot more fire than Penn State did, and Penn State just looked flat in the second half.
And then, you know, after falling behind 9-8, Shane Sturgis able to get a goal with 4 minutes to go. But, you know, it was one of two goals scored in the fourth quarter, and it kind of seemed like, you know, the game came to a little bit of a screeching halt there in the fourth quarter. You know, only two goals over the last 20 minutes. Was it a defensive effort that kind of made that happen, or was it more just sloppy offense? What was your impression of kind of how things happened, and then obviously your thoughts on Penn State being able to tie it?
It was a little bit of a – it got really, really slow towards the end. I think both teams came out and kind of played one-quarter games, really. Penn State in the first half and then Ohio State in the third quarter. And then the fourth quarter, I guess both teams were tired. There wasn't as much transition. There was a lot of grinded-out possessions that didn't really come to any fruition with a goal. And both goaltenders, to their credit, once again, it was just like last week with John Kemp and Austin Cowell. Greg Dutton and Austin Cowell again, it was a great battle of the goalkeepers. The transition game was slowed dramatically in the second half. A lot of great rides we saw from Ohio State that slowed Penn State's high octane offense, and Ohio State didn't really generate much in the fourth quarter until Shane Sturgis got that tying goal towards the end, where once again Jack Forrester, who had a great day dishing the ball, found Sturgis behind the net, and Sturgis scored his first goal, his patent goal from behind the net. But it was only his first goal in two games. It's kind of cooled off for Shane Sturgis right now after having such a big first two games of the season.
And then in overtime, Ohio State wins the faceoff, gets a set up possession, not able to get much. Penn State taking it down to the other end, calls timeout. And then one of the things that I'm kind of surprised to almost, you know, if you'd asked me at the beginning of the season, would you ever see a 30-second stall warning and then a violation in overtime, I think I would have scratched my head and said no. But that's exactly what happened to Penn State. How did that unfold?
It was very, very congested for Penn State on the crease. There was no flow to the offense, and Jeff Tamburini was not too happy with his guys and said that they didn't play courageous enough in overtime and come out with enough fire and enough presence of mind to just want to go after it right away. They kind of slowed it down and played to Ohio State's hand. Ohio State came out with their zone defense throughout the whole game, but especially in overtime, did not allow a lot of space for Penn State. And it cost them in the end because of that stall warning, and Ohio State was able to come down the other end of the field.
And then the game-winning goal with less than 1 second remaining on the clock. It was off of a quick restart. You know, you mentioned Jesse King obviously having himself a day. I guess just kind of, you know, how did that shake out?
Well, for the second week in a row, Penn State loses in overtime off the stick of a very impressive freshman. Carter Brown, like you said, off that quick restart, throws a Hail Mary from the right corner of the end line and just throws one right in front of the net. And it was poor defense on Penn State's part, not having a head on the swivel. Like you're taught when you're a kid, you got to make sure you're watching the ball, watching the man at the same time. And Jesse King was able to cut backside, cut right on the crease, somehow caught the ball. It was unbelievable. But a great play by Carter Brown, the presence of mind to just throw it into the scoring area, and Jesse King found it like he did the ball all day, it seemed like. And he just beat Cal right in front. And it was a good time for Ohio State flooding the field, but in Happy Valley, it was a pretty somber scene on the field.
Certainly the Buckeyes advanced to 4-0, cracked the top 20 deservingly this week in the, I believe, both polls, but I haven't gotten a chance to check that out just yet. But, yeah, Pat, unbelievable game for you to catch again this week, and we certainly appreciate having you back on the podcast as the Penn State Nittany Lions look to rest up and head into another big showdown against Lehigh at the Whitman Sampler Independence Classic at PPL Park on Saturday. So thanks again for joining us on the podcast. We'll talk to you again soon.
No problem, Terry. Thank you very much for having me on.
And the Inside Lacrosse Reflex podcast continues with Chris Mueller, a Robert Morris student who was on campus today to watch the Drexel Dagons come away with a 13-12 victory over the Robert Morris Colonials. Chris, thank you very much for joining us. Obviously, Drexel coming in on a three-game win streak, including a couple of close finishes, first against Albany, then against Villanova, two-game win streak, I'm sorry. And Robert Morris trying to get, you know, what would probably amount to a big out-of-conference win for them. Just coming into the game, what did it feel like being in the stadium in Moon Township today?
You know, Terry, it was a good vibe. Robert Morris came into the game, you know, winning two straight as well as Drexel, but, you know, not the same caliber opponents as a Drexel team. So going into the game, they really were hoping to pull out the upset, but in the end, Drexel, you know, came back to win. And it was a great game, a tough game. RMU was leading for most of it, but after talking to several of the players and coaches on Drexel's program, you know, they felt they didn't play to their standards and were happy to come out with the win in the end, but felt that they needed to play better going into the rest of the season.
Definitely interesting, development, a seesaw battle, and like you said, it was really, you know, kind of felt like maybe the Colonials had control of the game heading into the last few minutes. With about 8 minutes to go, jump out to a 12-10 lead, Drexel scoring the last three goals of the game. What were those last 8 minutes like?
Robert Morris, yeah, as you said, they were up two, and everything seemed to be going their way, but Drexel ultimately just won the faceoffs, and that's what Coach Drew McMinn pointed to. You know, he said, we didn't do a great job of winning those faceoffs, and that led to us giving up a two-goal lead late. And, you know, Drexel capitalized on their opportunities and were fortunately to come back three goals straight and come out with the win.
Frank Fusco scored to put the Dragons up one with a minute 55 to go. How did the last 2 minutes unfold? Did Robert Morris have any chances to equalize?
Yes, they did. They had the last opportunity of the game. You know, Drexel had the ball late with about like 30 seconds to go, and Robert Morris forced a turnover, called a timeout, and had 25 seconds with the ball around midfield. And they tried to devise a plan with their coaching staff, but they got it down to about, I would say, getting it into Drexel's box, but then something happened where Rankle, one of the midfielders, dropped a pass or it got hit out of the stick, and fortunately Drexel came out, no shot, nothing. They cleared the ball down the field, and that was the end of it. A heartbreaking loss for the Colonials, to tell you the truth.
You said you mentioned talking with Coach McMahon after the game, and you know, I think that when you look at Robert Morris's schedule, they're a team that really struggles to put together a quality out-of-conference schedule because of, you know, not just their location in Pittsburgh, but also the reputation of the program as being a little bit of a giant killer. And this was going to be, if you know, one of their few opportunities to score a big out-of-conference win. What was kind of his mood afterwards, and you know, did he talk about how this game sets him up for the rest of the season?
Yes, he did. You know, Terry, he told me basically his mood was, you know, although he was upset about, you know, losing a close game, he was sort of pleased with the way his team battled against a tough Drexel opponent who lost to Virginia earlier in the season by one. So, you know, although they didn't come out with the W, he was, you know, sort of like pleased to play the way they did against Drexel. And you know, you're right. Drexel was probably the toughest out-of-league opponent that Robert Morris will face all year. And if they were able to pull out a victory, you know, it would have said a lot about how their program is rising and continuing to, you know, try to get up to the top levels of Division I on lacrosse.
And on the flip side, you know, talking with Brian Volker and you know, some of the Dragons post game, it's an interesting spot that they're in now, being 3-1 with only a overtime loss to Virginia. But at the same time, it's a little bit of a familiar spot for a team that's kind of perpetually been on the bubble of the NCAA tournament. And I'm sure this is a year that they're looking to break through. What was the mood in the Drexel locker room post game?
The Drexel locker room mood was, you know, happy with the win, but they were fortunate to get a win. Coach Volker, as you said, he was not pleased with the way his team played. He actually told me, this is probably a direct quote, he said, if we want to get to where we want to be, we need to play better than we did today, which, you know, said a lot. They know they have to do better, and I had the chance to talk to Robert Church, who had 7 points on the day, and what he told me was, you know, they didn't play well in the first half. They got off to a slow start, but the difference between this year and last year was that they are beginning to win these one-goal games, as opposed to last year when they were on the bubble but could not pull off the, you know, one-goal margin victories like they needed to. So he was happy about, you know, coming out on top in such a short margin of a game.
Excellent. Well, Chris, thank you so much for the summary and the recap and joining us from Pittsburgh. We really appreciate the effort on the blog and the time here on the podcast. Hopefully we'll talk to you again soon.
Yep, no problem. Thank you, Terry.
Inside the Cross Podcast.